As it turned out, the whole time I was sweating, Russell was just pulling his normal rostered KP. For my first day with the unit, I'd organized George Clark to have a big stainless steel pot of orange juice ready for the boys when they returned from their run. This morning, when we got back, who should be ladling out the juice but my midnight foe, Private Russell, sporting two black eyes, a split lip, and a slightly battered nose. "Good morning, Russell," I said. "What happened to you?"
"Fell down, sir, last night in the motor pool."
"You okay?"
"Just fine, sir."
And that was it. Word never got to the colonel, and Russell and I never spoke of it again. The job of duty officer was rostered, and a week or so later I was pulling it again. A young soldier with a strange old man's face told me, with drafty directness, that I should learn to be more tolerant. I told him I'd think about it, and dashed back to the orderly room to look up the word in the dictionary. Upon consideration, the boy was right. So the following week, I practiced tolerance, but I wasn't very good at it, so I decided to give it up. Even so, it had been a good week, because during this broad-minded phase, I decided to try to straighten out another wise-ass drafty soldier, Gary Weinstein from New York City. Weinstein, who had a master's or a PhD from some hotshot Eastern University, hated the Army. His dress and manner bordered on insubordination from the moment he woke up until the moment he went to bed. His attitude was not uncommon among the drafty EM of the 50s. During its boom years, AD got all the brains the Army could commandeer, and guys like Weinstein often worked overtime to logically and articulately incite riot among their less educated peers. In Weinstein's case, I decided to use his thick tongue and brilliant mind to my advantage. DA was always sending down We of the White Hats anti-communist propaganda and other guidance to be served up to the troops. Even though Weinstein was an eight-ball private in the radar section, I made him troop information NCO, responsible for getting the word out through weekly troop info lectures. It was the perfect job for him. He jazzed up the talks a bit. The other troopers loved listening to him, and almost before I knew it, this sad sack EM became the sharpest soldier, not just of C Battery, but of the entire 47th Brigade, winning the highest honor of Brigade Soldier of the Year. Weinstein was so proud of that one, and so was I, that he gave me an autographed photo of Brigade C.G. Willis Perry presenting him with the award. I'd been wearing my soldier suit again for almost 9 months now. It had taken about 3 to get the battery into shape. Since then, I'd been bored and increasingly restless. I submitted numerous applications to go to the newly formed Special Forces, but was again and again rejected on the grounds that the unit did not require AD officers at this time. My protests that I was not an AD officer fell on deaf ears. The establishment of special forces seemed to be the new look's only concession to an army growing increasingly automatic. Talk within the military and without was of push-button warfare, a concept that would make ground forces more or less redundant. I found the whole idea difficult to believe, much less accept. To begin with, an army with no reliance on the soldier could hardly call itself an army. And though I was as enthusiastic as the next guy for the bigger bang for the buck weapons systems under development in 1956, it seemed to me that, except in the event of all-out war with the Soviet Union, the new gear would be as appropriate as using a sledgehammer to swat at flies. When I'd first arrived in Italy in 1946, I couldn't understand why the one-man guard box at our camp in Cormones was exceptionally thick-walled solid concrete. But I'd gotten a picture pretty damn quick when one day I found myself sharing the thing with Jimmy Sparks, both of us shaking in our boots as sniper fire, which moments before had caught us in the open, zinged and thudded against the sides of the box. Only a couple of hundred yards from our tank gate, a hidden communist Yugoslav partisan was making his presence known, but no one could ever get at him. Every time we tried, the jug and his weapon would simply disappear. It had been my first introduction to guerrilla warfare, and as time passed in Italy during those initial Cold War years, again and again I saw examples of insurgent war on the cheap.
When they could get the explosives, the Jugs would mine the road. The first KIAs I ever saw were an American captain and his driver both killed when their jeep hit a mine. Strangely, at the time, what had struck me even more than the dead men was the blanket of $20 MPCs that covered the ground all around them. The captain had been an 88th Division pay officer. When the Jugs couldn't get the big stuff, they just tied piano wire across the road between two trees at about jeep windshield level. Then they'd go away, leaving the Americans to lop their own heads off when they came barreling through the invisible wire, windshields down at 40 or 50 miles per hour. Once on patrol, someone on the lead vehicle had seen strands of piano wire stretched across the ground. Immediately, the entire column stopped, and while we spent the next hour probing for mines, in my mind's eye, I saw a little Jug laughing in the woods at how he, single-handedly, had held up a whole Yankee armored recon company. Nuclear weapons, with Eisenhower's threat of massive retaliation if the Kremlin made a move, had not stopped war. They had only changed its face. Though Hiroshima and Nagasaki had marked the end of World War II-style unconventional victories and the advent of Korea-style no-win conflicts, in the 10 years since VJ Day, there had been dozens of decisive wars, not the least of which was the Chinese Revolution under Mao, where from a tiny band of insurgents came the overthrow of a government set in granite. Guerrilla war, not push-button war, was the wave of the future. It could only flourish under the protection of the bomb. And it was my kind of war because it was the kind that a man, not a missile, had to fight to win. I spent those restless months in the 77th studying everything I could on the subject of guerrilla warfare, the colony's Indian-style tactics in response to the French, and then the British prior to and during America's Revolutionary War. The Filipino tactics after the Spanish-American conflict, which had young Lieutenant Douglas MacArthur inches from buying the farm when a Filipino guerrilla sniper shot his hat right off his head. The Soviet, French, American, and Yugoslav guerrilla activity during World War II. The British struggle in Malaya. And, most recently, the humiliating French defeat in Indochina. And I watched with particular interest the ongoing activities of a young Cuban stud named Castro, who was beginning to nickel and dime that tyrant Batista to death. More power to him, I thought. In the meantime, life at Sea Battery went on uneventfully, until the morning one of my soldiers fell out on the beach with a collapsed lung. As the colonel's phone rang hot with beachfront property owners complaining that their breakfasts had been disturbed yet again by that maniac, me, I put in my application to be relieved from active duty. Colonel Thiessen now had his reason to can me, and through Milo Rowell, word came down in a big hurry that that was just what he intended to do. The rumor was I was to be transferred to battalion staff as S2. To my mind, selling insurance was preferable to being the intelligence officer in an AD battalion in Manhattan Beach, California, especially when the reassignment was in fact punishment for just doing my job. Training had always been the bane of all the armed services. After World War II, it went soft, well attested to by the horrific casualties in the early days of Korea. The American people were shocked. How could the government have allowed their sons to go off to war so ill-prepared? Those of us who'd been trained well and fought through those bleak days wondered the same thing. Those who survived to become training madmen in Korea carried the same passion into their subsequent commands. There, we were thwarted before we'd hardly begun. With neither the means nor the blessings of the powers that be, apparently there was no room for training madmen in this peacetime army. Ike's budget cuts were the first obstacle toward maintaining a combat-ready army ground force. Gasoline, live ammo, and adequate training facilities all cost money. Ike's austerity kick gave us barely enough dough to conduct morning PT. Then there was the draft, which brought into the Army not just uneducated kids from the wrong side of the tracks, but university graduates with minds of their own. Many were pampered punks from whom a drill sergeant had two choices, either spoon-feed them into acquiescence or ramrod them into submission. Most good sergeants chose the firm but fair latter course. The Army was never meant to be a democratic organization. On the battlefield, there's no time to say please or take a vote on who's going to knock out a machine gun. The fact is, a soldier's response must be automatic and based in a philosophy about killing that simply cannot be taught in a classroom. Kill or be killed, hands-on training, in the control of a seasoned, hard-assed NCO can often mean the difference between life and death for a boy on the battlefield. Take the case of Willie Lump-Lump, whose tragic story, well known among my men, went something like this. After World War II, a boy named Willie Lump-Lump enlisted in the Army. He went to Fort Benning to take his infantry training, 16 weeks of sweat and tears and lots of punishment to turn him into a hardened soldier. Along about the 7th week of training, a sergeant stood up in front of his class and said, "Gentlemen, I'm Sergeant Slasher, and today I'm going to introduce you to the bayonet. On guard." With that, the sergeant went into the correct stance for holding the bayonet. "On the battlefield," he continued, "you will meet the enemy, and there will be times when you will need this bayonet to defeat the enemy, to kill the enemy. Over the next weeks, you'll be receiving a 20-hour block of instruction on the bayonet, and I will be your principal instructor." Willie Lump-Lump went back to the barracks deeply upset. "Man, that was so brutal out there today," he thought. "The war is over. We're living in peace and tranquility, and still the Army is teaching us how to use these horrible weapons." "Dear Mom," he wrote home, "today the sergeant told me he's going to teach me how to use the bayonet to kill enemy soldiers on the battlefield." Willie's mother was shocked. She got right on the phone. "Hello, Congressman Duguid. This is Mrs. Lump-Lump. I want to tell you what's happening down at Fort Benning, Georgia. Here it is 1949, and they're teaching my baby to kill with the bayonet. It's uncivilized. It's barbaric." The congressman immediately got on the horn. "Hello, General Play It Right at the Pentagon. This is Congressman Duguid. I understand the Army is still giving bayonet training." "Yes, we are." "Do you think it's a good idea? I don't think it's a very good thing at all. It's even somewhat uncivilized. I mean, really, how many times does a soldier need his bayonet?" "Not very often, sir, it's true. Actually, I was just reviewing the Army training program myself, and I was thinking that the bayonet is a pretty obsolete weapon. I agree with you. I'll put out instructions that it's going to stop." The next day, 700 miles away, "Gentlemen, I am Sergeant Slasher. This is your second class on bayonet training." The sergeant was interrupted by a lieutenant walking purposefully toward him across the training field. "Stand easy, men." "It's out," the lieutenant whispered. "What?" said the sergeant. "It's out," the lieutenant whispered again. The sergeant nodded, his mouth wide open in disbelief. He returned to his class. "Gentlemen, we'll have to break here. It looks as if bayonet training has been discontinued in the Army." A year later, PFC Lump-Lump, the model soldier, deployed to Korea with the 1st Battalion, 15th Regiment, 3rd Infantry Division. He was standing on a frozen hill, and the Chinese were coming at him, wave after wave after wave. Willie stood like a rock. Resolutely, he shot the enemy down. Suddenly, he realized he was out of ammunition. He looked at his belt. Not a round left. He saw a Chinaman rushing toward him. He remembered the first class on bayonet training. He reached down and pulled his bayonet out of his scabbard. Shaking and fumbling, he tried to fit it on the end of his weapon. But by that time, the Chinese soldier was standing over him with the bayonet of his own. The Secretary of the Army signed his 1,000th letter for the day. "Dear Mrs. Lump-Lump, it is with deep regret that I must inform you that your son, PFC Willie Lump-Lump, was killed in action 27 November 1950. Heartbroken, Mrs. Lump-Lump wrote to some friends of young Willie's in the company. "How?" she asked. "Why?" "Willie wasn't trained," they wrote back. "He didn't know how to use his bayonet." Now Mrs. Lump-Lump was not only heartbroken, but outraged. She didn't even bother to call Congressman Duguid. She barged right into his office. "Why?" she cried and screamed. "Why wasn't my son trained for war?" The mythical Willie Lump-Lump was my training aide. I used him in every unit I commanded to explain two things to the troops. First, that the training they were about to receive was in their best interests, and second, that the civilian population didn't know diddly squat about the realities of war, because as much as any other factor, civilian interference was what was leading the post-Korea Army training program down the tubes. A few months before my trooper fell out on the beach, there'd been an incident at the Paris Island Marine Corps Training Center. A drill sergeant named McKeon had gotten his 74-man platoon of recruits out of bed for a night march in order, he said, to teach them discipline. The end result was 6 dead boots swept down a fast-running creek on the island. McKeon was court-martialed, and the entire military training system went on trial by the press. Heads rolled on Paris Island as bleeding-heart civilians got on their soapboxes and called for an end essentially to any training that carried with it even the slightest risk of danger. The military overreacted. When Paris Island's CG was transferred out of his command, a chill went down the spines of all the new-style self-serving commanders I'd met in and since my second tour in Korea, who put their careers above their missions and their men. But for the grace of God, they thought and gratefully accepted the new training safety regulations sent down from the top. It was a long, long way from Blue Devil Day in Gorizia, Italy, the one day each month when all units in the 88th Blue Devil Division were put through their paces. At one of these, I'd been going through the bayonet training drill and managed to vertical buttstroke my squad leader, who was dancing in front of me, daring me to get him, right in the chops with my M1 rifle. My regimental commander, Colonel Ball, who'd strolled by just as the sergeant fell to the ground in a shower of blood and teeth, hadn't even flinched. "Good work, soldier," he'd said, speaking from the experience of 3 years of the toughest combat in World War II in Africa, Sicily, and Italy. "Good training." The only way to prepare men for combat is to train them in conditions as close to the real thing as possible. A CO has to be prepared to take his lumps in training. Soldiers cannot be trained in a classroom, then be thrown onto a battlefield and be expected to cope. In fighter company, I'd taken my share of wounded in our company in the attack demonstrations, guys hit by shrapnel from a shell landing a little too close in, but I'd been willing to take that risk, because I wanted those people to know what it was like to have a mortar round slam down in front of them and hear machine gun slugs snap over their heads. The average 2% training casualties we had, to my mind, were a small premium for an insurance policy that could cover a whole unit when the real shooting started. The McKeon case was just a terrible tragedy. The sergeant was charged with 6 counts of involuntary manslaughter, oppression of recruits, and drinking on duty. With the help of powerful testimony from the greatest Marine of them all, Lieutenant General Lewis B. Chesty Puller, McKeon was eventually acquitted of the manslaughter and oppression of recruits charges. McKeon was found guilty of negligent homicide and drinking. He received a harsh sentence, most of which was commuted by the Secretary of Navy a few months after the trial. But the verdict did not calm the fluttering hearts of Colonel Thiessen and his ilk, and peacetime Army training continued its downhill spiral, the horrible consequence of which would not be seen for another decade. As just one company commander in the next war would say, we got kids in combat who believed that people were just shooting blanks at them. They really believed they couldn't die out there. The 47th Brigade XO, Colonel William Shanahan, persuaded me not to quit the Army over Colonel Thiessen. He told me a new unit, the 108th Arty Group, had recently been formed to control the 4 Nike Ajax missile battalions being developed around Los Angeles. If I wanted a new job, he said, he could organize me to be group logistics officer. I jumped at the offer before it was halfway out of the colonel's mouth. My primary mission in the new assignment was to coordinate all missile site construction with the Army's Los Angeles-based district engineers. I also handled special logistic work, mostly written studies on everything from relocation of established facilities to reports on moisture content in missile storage areas, and what corrective action might be taken. Based at Fort MacArthur, I was most fortunate to have as a boss Major Edward McKinnon, an old soldier and a damn good man. Major Mac was a joy to work for. He played the role of teacher in the early days of my staff job, patiently rewriting my papers with me by his side until I got the hang of it. Senior Clerk Master Sergeant James Cook saved my ass on more than one occasion, too, as he helped me negotiate the maze of jargon that characterized all Army correspondence. As well, because the job required considerable traveling, I was authorized both an Army sedan and a driver logistics clerk of my choice. The first time I saw Private Tom Martin, he was mowing the lawn in front of Group HQ. Without a doubt, he was the sloppiest American soldier I'd ever seen in my Army career. His fatigue cap was kind of hanging off the back of his head. His fatigue uniform was so wrinkled that there was no doubt in my military mind that he slept in it. His boots weren't shined, his trousers weren't bloused, his hair badly needed a cut, and big clumps of stubble darkened his extraordinarily poorly shaved face. The term sad sack took on new meaning for me. I went over to him to deliver a little on-the-spot correction. To my great surprise, he obligingly got himself together, and as we talked, I realized this sad sack was one very smart guy, a new replacement trained in high-speed telegraph. Martin was still awaiting assignment. When he said he could drive, type, and had 13 years of Jesuit schooling, that was all I needed to know. I went to Captain Johnson, the Group HQ battery commander, to organize the private as my clerk assistant. Johnson thought I was crazy. "Have you seen him? He's a disgrace to the uniform." The captain went on to tell me that Tom was a smart-ass college draftee whom nobody wanted and whom he felt sure he'd end up kicking out of the Army. I insisted, saying that I thought the boy had a lot of potential, and I'd really like the challenge of shaping him up. Finally, with great reluctance, Johnson assigned Tom to Group S4. Tom got to work on time the first day, but that was about all that could be said in his favor. He hadn't shined his shoes. He'd painted them. His brass was positively green. His khaki uniform looked even worse than his baggy fatigues, and he was wearing white socks. I knew in an instant that the guy wasn't going to change, and that the hardest part of my job would be just keeping him out of Captain Johnson's sight. So I became Tom's protector, and at the same time, he became mine. I taught him how to shine his brass, badgered him to keep his uniform neat and tidy, and made sure he and Johnson's paths never crossed. In return, he wrote the staff studies. Each evening, we'd come back from our little sojourns in the field and talk through the problem. I'd provide the guidance from a military standpoint, and Tom would take my views and work them into a knockout of a paper. From the first one we submitted, the kudos kept on coming. With Tom at the wheel of our Army sedan, the two of us drove around Los Angeles virtually every day doing our logistics thing. It was good duty. We usually finished the work by noon, and because my secondary self-assigned mission was to keep Tom as far from HQ and Captain Johnson as possible, I felt totally justified in taking the afternoons off and not bringing him home until dark. The job was great for Tom, too. After all those years in the seminary, he'd quit just a couple weeks before he was to take the priestly plunge. Now he was like a kid playing hooky from school. He was brilliant at playing the horses. The Jesuits had sharpened his keen mathematical mind to a razor's edge, and we spent as much time at Hollywood Park as we did at our job. In the line of duty, we'd often go out for lunch, too, and took great pleasure in destroying the complacency of Southern California suburbia. One afternoon, for example, we were sitting in an outdoor restaurant near Hollywood. The waiter was hovering anxiously nearby, probably because we were in uniform and carrying rolled-up blueprints and building plans, so in a low voice, just loud enough for his benefit, I said, "You know, Tom, I really think that real estate across the street would be perfect for a missile site." The real estate in question was like Saks Fifth Avenue. Tom immediately picked up his cue. "I've just been thinking the same thing, sir, and we could put the acquisition radar on that little hill over there. It wouldn't be too tough to move Griffith Observatory, would it, sir?" "No sweat," I replied. "This is military priority. We're talking about the defense of the nation." The waiter's eyes bulged out of his head. Tom and I often wondered how far or how fast the land prices in that neighborhood came tumbling down after the whisper got going that the military was about to condemn it all and take it over. Another day, we'd just picked up some stuff downtown at the L.A. District Engineers and decided to go to the Hilton for lunch. As we walked into the lobby, Tom suddenly stopped and dramatically unrolled a blueprint he was carrying. Now I was the one to pick up the cue. I looked from the blueprint to the hotel lobby. Yes, I think this will be fine. We'll just cordon off this area here, shut down all the elevators except this one here. Of course, we'll need security on top. Meanwhile, Tom had whipped out his pad and was taking notes. The assistant manager came bustling up. May I help you, gentlemen? He'd caught me off guard. I put on my most official voice. Haven't you been informed? No, sir, I haven't. Well, I don't have the security clearance to tell you myself, but you will be informed. The chief of staff of the army should be ringing any minute to tell you who'll be coming. I tried to make the mysterious VIP sound like God. The assistant manager hurried off. Just before he got out of earshot, I turned back to Tom. We'll have to remove all that glass, too, in case someone decides to bomb the joint. With that, we went into the dining room, and within a few minutes, the hotel manager came up to the table. I understand you've been looking over the hotel. May I ask for what reason? By this time, both Tom and I realized we'd been guilty of overacting. We'd surreptitiously taken off our name tags the second we sat down to prevent our little joke from blowing up in our faces. Still, we were in too deep now not to play the drama out. I told the manager how sorry I was for the slip-up in communications, that I was not authorized to tell him why we were there. But the minute we got back to headquarters, we'd advised the general, who would, of course, call him. The manager was really thrown as he walked away from the table. I felt kind of bad, but there wasn't anything I could do. Finally, we finished our meal and went to pay the bill. Oh, no, sir, the cashier said, whisking away the check. The manager said it's on the house. Compliments of the Hilton. And who said there's no such thing as a free lunch? On one of the rare days, I was working at my desk. A good-looking E4 walked into the office. At first, I didn't recognize him. All I saw was a snazzy, starched uniform, perfectly polished brass and shoes, a rigid attention, and a brilliantly executed salute. Then I noticed the 77th Battalion's crests on his epaulets. It was ex-Private Russell, whom I'd decked in the 77th's motor pool. He was at Fort Mac Separation Center being discharged. He came in to say goodbye and to thank me for kicking his ass. I deserved it, he said. And I kind of figured if you were willing to risk your career to make a soldier out of me, maybe I should give it a try. But you know something, Captain? He continued. I could have nailed you. My uncle is Senator Richard Russell, and if he'd heard about that fight. And with that, the nephew of the chairman of the all-powerful Senate Armed Services Committee tossed me another great salute and marched out in style. And as everyone in the office commented on the fine-looking trooper and asked who he was, I quietly quaked in my boots and told them he was just one of my boys, a fine Georgia boy. Russell's visit really moved me, but for a while afterward, I wondered whether I'd have let him get on a first-name basis with my fists if I'd known who he was. Chances were the answer was yes, for two reasons. First, because you always go with what you know, and I knew the kid needed a little knuckle drill. And second, because as a rule, I lived and worked by gut feeling. In my gut, I knew Russell was a good man, just as gut feeling told me Tom Martin was a good man. If you went out on a limb for guys like that, they'd come through for you, too, as Tom did one Saturday morning a couple of weeks later when I overslept after a big poker game with some Woodbury College buddies. A big briefing had been planned for Brigade C.G. Perry and his staff, and at H-10, I, the briefer, was still in bed. I jumped up, shaved in 10 seconds flat, and raced down to Fort Mac at 100 miles an hour. I got there within about a minute to spare, only to find the charts already set up and Tom Martin standing by, shined, starched, and spruced up like a perfect trust trooper, prepared, if necessary, to give the briefing himself. As it turned out, the general was delayed, so I had a chance to wash the blood off my face. But the point was, I'd never seen old Sad Sack Tom voluntarily get himself together before, but when I needed him most, he was there, looking like Soldier of the Month. My roommate during this period was General Perry's aide, Bill Cowart. Bill was a stud of an officer, a lawyer from Florida who'd commanded a missile battery in the 933rd before moving up to brigade. We'd become friends when I was in 77th. When I moved up to Fort Mac, we got an apartment together. As two of the few single officers around, Our nights were as busy as our days. It was an exciting time, and whoever scored first would hang a Do Not Disturb sign in the form of a necktie on the front doorknob, so the other knew to find himself another place to sleep for the night. Living with the general's aide had lots of benefits, not the least of which was getting the hot skinny on virtually anything, often before it happened. Bill had been instrumental in getting Shanahan to persuade me to stay in the service. Now he told me he'd heard, because of the good work I was doing, I could well be scooped up and promoted to brigade as a staff officer in S3. I got Major McKinnon to block that move. Thanks to Tom, I was thinking and writing more clearly and logically every day, but I was afraid I'd sink without him around to put those words on the page. Then good Major Mack fell victim to the Reductions in Force RIF program, just one of thousands upon thousands of casualties in Ike's continuing savage attack on the Army's ground strength. The RIF program was another great tragedy of the new look. It weakened the fiber of the Army by destroying not only its might, but its morale. No reserve officer on active duty with less than 18 years active service to the day was safe. Scores of men at Fort Mac, well into their 17th year, left work on Friday and on Monday reported to their units only to find they'd been canned. The chop always came without warning or even apparent thought. A bad ER from a decade ago, no college degree, a letter of reprimand, or the tiniest recorded indiscretion carried more weight than Purple Hearts or Valor Awards won in the service of the country. Still, a man wasn't forced to quit if he were riffed, but if he wanted to stay in, he had to take whatever sharp, equally arbitrary demotion the Army selected. Most who stayed were, understandably, bitter. In the 77th, I'd had a first sergeant who had been a lieutenant colonel, and he simply could not adjust. Finally, I'd eased him out to a plush job at Fort Mac and replaced him with proud, longtime NCO Master Sergeant Lee. The most pathetic case of all was that of Fort Mac's deputy post commander. This bird colonel with enough valor decorations and Purple Hearts from two wars as an infantry commander to run from his belly button to his epaulet was riffed. He'd had about 17 and a half years active service and another decade in the Guard. When I heard about it, I didn't give it much thought, except that it seemed funny they'd riffed a full colonel, until I walked through the PX and saw him, now a staff sergeant, stocking goodies on the shelves. I said hello, and I couldn't stop myself from referring to him as Sir. He could barely look me in the eyes. He had the saddest expression I'd ever seen on a man's face. It was as if his self-esteem and dignity had been stomped to dust on the PX floor. What a load of crap, I thought as I walked away, about the Army taking care of its own. As bad as RIF was for the guys getting axed, some of its worst casualties were in outstanding young officers like Bill Cowart. The Army was no longer a safe harbor. Job security was a thing of the past, and many, many good men who might otherwise have made a career of the military saw the writing on the wall and got out. And it wasn't just the young regular officers shagging ass for the door. A lot were enlisted and draftee studs with high IQs who'd been trained, at enormous expense to the government, to operate and maintain the new high-tech military equipment. Instead of settling for an uncertain career in the Army, these men eagerly snapped up the bait of civilian defense contractors who offered 10 times the Army salary for the same skills and frequently the same jobs. The losses were probably even more serious in the NCO Corps, where thousands of World War II and Korea vets, tough old squad leaders and platoon sergeants with 5 to 15 years service were tossed out of the Army during the RIF simply for not meeting the Army's arbitrary IQ scores. How much money was actually saved through the RIF program would be hard to estimate, but if you stopped to consider the quality lost and the damage done to the Army as an institution, it probably wasn't much. For myself, I considered every day I remained a captain another day under Damocles' sword, especially after the ER Colonel Thiessen rendered on me when I left C Battery. If that wasn't RIF material, I didn't know what was. It was so hot, in fact, that it burst into flames the minute it hit the office of brigade personnel. Luckily, I had a friend there who contained the damage, but he couldn't do anything to save that poor charred ER, so it never found its way into my DA records, and I was safe, at least for a while. It was more likely General Cleland's influence than anything else that kept me from being riffed. The only preventative measure I took, besides alerting the volunteer firemen at Brigade, was to enroll in night school to finish my Associate of Arts degree. With Tom around to help me write my term papers, it was pretty much a breeze, and the extra long days were well worth the effort if they kept me from being chucked out of the Army. Before I had a chance to become too sure of myself, though, a kick came in the form of Army Chief of Staff General Maxwell D. Taylor. At a meeting of the L.A. Association of the U.S. Army, the general spoke passionately about the necessity for higher education among the officer corps. I'd already heard the drill about getting a master's, but now Taylor added his desire that all of us achieve fluency in not one but two other languages, and I had enough trouble with English. The new look had brought with it not only a new wave of weaponry, but a new kind of warrior as well. Actually, the new breed was kind of a warrior diplomat, as bloodless ballistics seemed to be phasing out the role of fighters on future battlegrounds. The emphasis increased on the diplomatic side of soldiering. In fiscal 1954, the missile program accounted for $500 million of the defense budget, while conventional hardware got $3.7 billion. By fiscal 1959, we'd see a 180-degree swing, missiles getting $3.4 billion and conventional equipment $600 million. The competition was fierce. You either learned to dance and prance and speak Chinese, or you sat back and waited for your riff notice in the mail. Now it was not what you said or did that counted, but how, and old soldiers for whom diplomacy and tact were harder to master than jumping out of a plane or bonsaiing a hill were left shaking their heads like puzzled commuters staring at the schedule and wondering how they got on the wrong bus. The scenery was just so different. The most familiar, the most steeped in history, the most inspiring landmarks were one by one being razed to the ground. First to go were the distinctly Army brown shoes. In the name of cost efficiency, the new look policy was that black shoes would be worn by all services. Next on the hit list was the square-frame belt buckle. I found this one kind of strange. Unlike the new standard to all services brass buckle, the old one could not only hold up your trousers, but also open a beer faster than a conventional bottle opener. It was hard to believe that old Army Ike would sanction our giving up such a versatile item for a junky 39-cent single-function variety, but he did, again in the name of cost efficiency. Funnily, the belt buckles often separated the old warriors from the new diplomats. One glance around a room to see who was wearing what, because a lot of us refused to comply, was generally enough to pinpoint which army a guy was coming from. It might not have seemed like much. In the end, what difference did black shoes or brass buckles really make? But the fact was, it made a lot of difference. An institution was an institution, and for the old guys who balked at the new look, it wasn't a simple story of resisting change. Instead, it was an attempt to stave the flow of blood, which was pumping hideously out of an increasingly ashen army's veins. But then suddenly, it was too late, even for a tourniquet. Chief of Staff Taylor disbanded all the old army regiments, with all their history and tradition, to make way for new-look battle groups, each composed of five rifle companies. This battalionless five-sided system, designed for the nuclear battlefield, was fittingly called the Pentomic Army, and was virtually the first such major reorganization of forces since Valley Forge. It had its own jazzy vocabulary. An outpost line was now a combat outpost line, COPL, COPL. The front line was now the forward edge of the battle area, FEBA or FEBA. But the new lingo was more a public relations exercise than anything else. After all, a killing ground by any other name is still a killing ground. Within 5 years, the Pentomic concept would prove completely unworkable, and the Army would furtively reorganize once again, but the damage done in the meantime was, in a word, irreparable. One more of the last vestiges of the old Army disappeared when we traded in our familiar OD uniforms for new forest green ones. modeled before Congress by none other than Captain Joe Love, that fine soldier I'd met in Korea when we relieved his unit in the Gap. The new gear was a close copy of the German Wehrmacht uniform of World War II, from the Prussian-style billed service cap to the heels of the coal-black shoes. The German look didn't bother me much. No question, but the Germans were brilliant in all things military, even if they didn't win many wars. And in the years following World War II, all kinds of German designs went on permanent loan to the U.S. Army. The M60 machine gun bore a striking resemblance in function to the German MG-34. Our self-propelled anti-tank weapon, SPAT or SPAT, was much like the famed Kraut 88mm, except that ours, like the new belt buckle, was on the cheap tinny side and was down with maintenance problems most of the time. The missile program was in the hands of former Nazi scientists who'd surrendered to the Americans at war's end, led by Wernher von Braun, developer of the space-age ballistic V-2. Somebody up there was definitely fascinated with the German war machine. It seemed to me we copied virtually everything the Germans had to offer except their leadership and discipline techniques. We would have done well to examine this aspect of German might, too, as, in fact, it accounted for much of their military strength. Instead, the Army dealt a thoughtless blow to the very foundation of leadership by instituting yet another new-look policy. Name tags, to be sewn onto all fatigues and personalized badges, the name in white on black plastic, like the ones Tom and I deep-sixed at the Hilton, to be pinned on all dress uniforms. The philosophy behind those name tags was as transparent as cellophane and about as flimsy. To me, their advent was a sure sign that U.S. Army leadership was on a downhill slide. Napoleon was said to have been able to recall 50,000 of his soldiers by name. In the new army, a CO didn't even have to learn five. Yet, know your men was a crucial principle of leadership, and that meant not just their names, but where they were from, what they thought, what made them tick. Name tags were all very well for the new style officer who stayed in a peacetime command only long enough to jockey his way into a better career-furthering slot. Why bother memorizing names, went his thinking, he'd never use again. But for the trooper, personalized uniforms were just another gimmicky example of an increasingly impersonal, almost corporate army, one difficult to love, let alone have the allegiance to, that would serve him and the country well in the event of war. In July, I replaced Tom's nemesis, Captain Johnson, as the 108th Arty Group's HQ Battery CO. It was goodbye staff work, hello command, and I was thrilled. HQ Battery was responsible for the administration of the Brigade Group Air Section, Motor Pool, Acquisition Radars, and the AAOC itself. I was the only officer in a command of more than 400 men, which necessitated two things pronto. One, a good first sergeant. The other, a couple of sharp assistants to help with the stacks of paperwork that came with the job. I was dumbfounded when I couldn't find one decent master sergeant to be top kick. None of them wanted it. Most were longtime AD men who'd found their niche in jobs such as gym or reenlistment NCO. They were happy as hell with their short hours and minimal responsibility. Finally, I gave up the search and appointed an enthusiastic Sergeant First Class named McRae. As I'd done with Hudson, Allison, and Smith in the 223rd, I let McRae wear the stripes, and the guy turned out just fine. I picked the eyes out of the new replacements to get my own staff together. Richard Coggy from Notre Dame, Ron Girard from San Diego State, and Ph.D. Joe Perez from NYU were the core of my brain trust, all of whom troubleshot for the battery and the boys, and, since Harbor College was ongoing, occasionally gave polish to my rough-as-a-cob term papers. Girard became a particularly good friend. He shared the same mania I had for running, and early on we got into the habit of doing 6 to 10 miles every morning. When the 77th was inactivated, I grabbed Gary Weinstein to be HQ Battery Troops Information NCO, and my dear friend Cordon Bleu George Clark to take charge of the mess. George was also the battery barber, a weird combination of talents I chose to ignore, especially when I started hearing he had a habit of dropping hot cigar ashes onto the heads of his barbershop customers, then brushing the client's hair off his uniform while dishing out chow. Tom Martin came over to the outfit, too, and continued a practice he'd initiated in the S4 shop, breaking the bank of a local bookie with the help of superb contacts he'd developed in the racing world as well as his own horse race enthusiasts' cartel. Tom's pre-race selection committee meetings were always held in my office. I often had an inner chuckle thinking how Captain Johnson would have reacted to the knowledge that every week his most hated sad sack was holding court at his very own old desk. The men I inherited with the unit were exceptional. I got to meet them all right away through my policy of paying every soldier myself. One poor troop was getting only $9 a month. When I asked him why, he said he was on statement of charges. He'd been a driver in D Battery 77th when a truck he'd parked rolled down a hill and caused $4,000 worth of damage to it and the other vehicles in the motor pool. The soldier was found responsible. Now it looked as if he'd be paying off the bill for the rest of his life through his meager army salary. The whole thing didn't seem too fair to me. I immediately put my brain trust to work to find a loophole. They did, and not only did the guy never have to fork out another cent, but we also managed to get back all the dough he'd paid in to date. Meanwhile, my stock went up 1,000% with the rest of the men of HQ Battery. This one act let them know that I was on their side. When I saw how the unit operated, everyone had a fixed job, generally shift work, and not too much bitching and moaning going on, I concluded these guys didn't need a shape-up as the boys in the 77th had. Instead, I decided on an informal command style. No formations, no police call, no inspections. I was studying sociology at school, so I looked at it all as an experiment of sorts. I simply put out the word that I expected the guys to keep themselves and the barracks looking good, that each man was to police up our area of the post as he went through the day, meaning pick up cigarette butts, candy wrappers, etc., attend mandatory training, and get to work on time. The experiment proved to be a great success. From day one, there were few problems, which is probably why I was compelled to do some ass-chewing, a rare opportunity these days, the morning, early in my tenure, that I walked out of an HQ group building while Jerry Lewis was shooting a scene for his movie The Sad Sack. When I stopped to watch, I noticed a couple of troopers, not mine, at the edge of the crowd. Both were leaning on their M1 rifles as if the things were goddamned canes, hands over the barrels, the ultimate of no-nos in my book. "Get your hands off the muzzles of those weapons," I snapped as I moseyed up behind them. Then I walked on and went back to watching the filming. A few minutes later, I glanced over, only to find that the two troopers had not moved their hands one inch. Such blatant insubordination was mind-boggling to me. I rushed over and chewed their asses into hamburger, only winding up the tirade when it became clear they weren't even listening. "What company are you from?" I demanded. "Paramount," one replied. "So fuck you, Jack," said the other. There wasn't much more I could say. I snuck away, only when noting the long hair each kid wore, which alone should have told me they were movie extras. Captain Johnson had left me with one unresolved problem, an RA corporal by the name of Jack Gallagher, who, at the time I took over the battery, was residing in L.A. County Jail on the charge of drunk driving. Under Army regulations, a soldier in a civilian jail was one well on his way to being booted out of the service. In Johnson's opinion, Gallagher's demise as a serving member of the U.S. Army could not come one day too soon. "A big boozer and an even bigger troublemaker," he explained, and recommended I let the corporal rot in the slammer until Army justice took its course. As soon as I got my new command squared away, I paid a visit to the wayward non-com. My first impression was that Jack Gallagher was a real soldier. Tall, thin, a few years older than I, Jack had fought with the 1st Ranger Battalion in World War II. That fact alone told me virtually everything I needed to know. Since most Rangers were cut from the same bolt of cloth, it was only natural that in a peacetime setting any of them would have trouble towing the Army line. Gallagher, who'd gone on to serve with distinction in Korea, reminded me of my wolfhound friend George Creamer, another fine soldier who was stationed at Fort Mac. George's job was recruitment, and to look at him was to look at a walking Army recruitment poster. paratrooper ranger, Korea Battlefield Commission, a high-stepping, highly decorated, good-looking, hard-fighting stud. But he was always in trouble. Every time he went into a bar, he'd get into a fight. George also had a glass jaw, which was unfortunate for someone with a penchant for duking it out, and most of the time I knew him at Fort Mac, it was broken. Sometimes I'd find him sitting at the bar of the officers' club, hungry as hell, bitching and moaning through his wired-up jaw that all he could eat was soup. A few martinis later, he'd be trying to push crackers through his teeth. The guy was an animal, and he didn't give a damn that he didn't fit into the stateside scene. He'd just shrug and say through his wireworks that what the peacetime army needed was a deep freeze to put the fighters in.
"Just leave them there," he'd say, "till you've got a war, then thaw them out and let them go win it."
And he was right. George spoke for all the warriors who couldn't make it in the peacetime army. Most were just too abrasive and outspoken. Too often, they'd said exactly what they thought and lived by the only law that counted to them, the one forged on the battlefield, where what was true and what was false, what was real and what was not, was as clear as a burst of Willie Peter in a midnight's starless sky. And that's the kind of guy Corporal Gallagher was. He wanted to stay in the army, but regulations or no regulations, he simply could not handle anything that didn't jibe with his own code of honor and justice. He made no excuses for his brushes with authority. He just explained them away. "You know the movie From Here to Eternity?" he asked me. I went to see it and got so excited I went right down to re-up, thinking I'd be getting back into the old army. But do you know what I found? Pink curtains, black shoes, and no bugler. It didn't take much for me to see that Jack Gallagher was my kind of soldier. And when I found out he shared an 11 November birthday with me and George Patton, there wasn't a doubt in my mind. I went to the judge who'd heard his case and worked out a deal to have the sentence. Then I went back to the battery and organized the paperwork to give Jack leave for the duration of his time in the Hoosgow. Within 2 weeks, he was back at Fort Mac, performing just like the hard-assed good man I knew he'd be, and he kept his promise never to drink and drive again. Alcoholism was a common problem, especially among long-term regulars. Booze was cheap and easy to get, and with all the social activities of the peacetime army, happy hours, officer, and NCO parties, it was virtually an accepted thing. In the military, drinking fell into the same category as pussy. The more you could put away, the more macho you were among your buddies. The only problem was that the line between being a stud and an alcoholic was a fine one, and once crossed was really hard to reverse. We'd had a brilliant clerk in S4 who bought scores of half-pint bottles of vodka every payday. Then he'd hide them throughout the administration building, in air conditioning vents, in the water cabinets of toilets, in file drawers. He'd even had one hanging from a string inside a water-filled fire extinguisher. He'd be sloshed to the gills till his pay ran out, then he'd start in on his secret cash. Unfortunately, unlike old Supply Sergeant Allison in the 77th, this senior specialist was totally ineffective when he was drinking. Major Mack, being the good man that he was, hadn't wanted to bust him. The guy was close to retirement, so he assigned me the additional duty of vodka patrol. The only way we knew to get this guy dried out was for me to ferret out all his little bottles before he had a chance to get to them. Major Mack himself was replaced by an alky, a mean little man who did nothing all day but drink and stare out the window. One morning I'd walked by his office and he was drinking out of a Brasso can. I'd seen guys, if they were really hard up, drinking aftershave lotion, but Brasso? A few days later, when he was out, I snuck a whiff of the can. It was good old Kentucky bourbon incognito. I guessed the guy's logic was that sipping hooch out of a Brasso can was better than buying a decent flask, an act that to him might have been just too close to admitting he had a problem. In HQ Battery, my favorite drinkers were James O. Johnson and Motor Pool Sergeant McNasty McCown. Johnson had also been with me in the 77th. Now, according to Jack Gallagher, he was never without a bottle of cheap wine and a Bermuda onion in his lunch bag. When he was broke, he'd hawk his wife's toaster and anything else that wasn't nailed down, and if those proceeds didn't last till the next payday, he'd just sidle up to me with a big smile and say, "Does the captain want his beautiful Chevy convertible polished? Sure does look like it could use a good shine." $20 and one sparkling clean car later, Johnson's smile was even broader, and it was "Watch out, Miss Sweet Lucy." Master Sergeant McCown ran the best damn motor pool I'd ever seen. We had about 300 vehicles. He kept them up, running, and looking good, and the Brigade Group Best Motor Pool Award was in HQ Battery's hands more often than in any other unit. The only problem was, come payday, Mac himself was up and running, and non compos mentis until his dough ran out. After a couple of months' observation, I decided his problem was not booze, but money. So every payday, I gave him a couple of back-to-back 3-day passes. He'd drink himself blind, spend all his cash, and when he was broke, he'd come back, dry out, and run that motor pool like no one else could. The living was easy that first summertime with HQ Battery. All told, I spent 20 months there, until the last days of August 1957, when the realities of the Cold War chilled the Southern California night air. In quick succession, the Soviets announced the first successful launching of an ICBM. The U.S. contender, the Air Force's Atlas, had yet to take to the skies. And then, only weeks later, the first ever space satellite was orbiting the Earth in the form of Russia's Sputnik. We had indeed been caught with our new-look pants down. A-bomb rattling had been going on for more than a decade. The 4 years the U.S. had had as the world's only atomic power had been the best for brandishing the nuclear sword. As early as 1946, when I was a little kid in Italy, word once filtered down to the troops that Truman was going to drop a super bomb on Yugoslavia over an incident involving an American plane shot down while overflying communist Jug airspace. And even after the Russians developed their own A-bomb in 1949, and their H-bomb in 1953, 9 months after the U.S., we'd still been able to use the bomb to great effect, or so it seemed, to coerce the communist Chinese to the Panmunjom bargaining table in Korea, to dampen Mao's enthusiasm for the islands of Kemoy and Matsu in 1954, and would again in 1958, and generally to keep the Kremlin itself at bay with warnings of massive retaliation with high-yield nuclear weapons already developed in America, like the 60-megaton bomb, the meanest and dirtiest in the arsenal, a vengeance weapon against Russia's cities if the Kremlin ever struck at U.S. cities first, announced by Livermore Laboratory just a month before the Soviets' triumphant ICBM launch. At the time, it sounded ominous enough, but the Reds had been playing their atomic cards close to their chests. The realities of push-button warfare were now brought home through the Russian breakthrough in the means of delivering the weapons, and our threatening claims appeared about as credible as the work of the House Un-American Activities Committee. To make matters worse, only 3 days after Sputnik, a Pentagon study revealed publicly that the Nike Ajax short-range anti-aircraft anti-missile missile, despite the billions of dollars spent on the crash program, was ineffective, with a jet aircraft and rocket kill rate of between 30% and 50%. Heretofore, the public had been told the system was close to 100% effective. There was a lot of hysteria. Los Angeles Air Defense went on full alert, and HQ Battery was faced with the requirement of organizing a special supply scheme for the acquisition radars. We had to be fully operational 24 hours a day. Not one system could be down lest the Kremlin decide to go for broke. And the routine requisitions setup was simply not designed for emergency resupply. We called our new section Blue Streak, and in the capable hands of now Staff Sergeant Jack Gallagher, not once in the rest of my time with the unit were we caught short on spare parts or equipment. Blue Streak got the highest priority, complete with jet airplanes and special couriers. It reached the point that a replacement part was there before anyone save Jack even knew we needed it. As HQ Battery CO, I was supposed to sign all the requisition forms, but it quickly proved to be an impossible requirement. They sometimes ran to a couple of hundred a day, and with elements of the battery spread over hundreds of coastal miles, Often I'd be an hour's drive from HQ when a request had to go. I got around the problem by changing my signature to one of big block letters that could be forged by Gallagher and First Sergeant McCrae. I'd learned as a young lieutenant that if you can't trust your NCOs, you're dead, and I never worried about it again. As a soldier, the thing that got to me most during the early post-Sputnik days was that I knew Los Angeles could not be defended by AD. Those very expensive super-duper radar systems that could spot enemy aircraft 300 miles away could not detect a target over the ocean 300 feet away in war games with the Navy. The planes got through simply by flying on the deck, below the radar's effective range, or through heavy ground clutter, and succeeded in bombing the shit out of the California coastline, theoretically, every time. It seemed so obvious that money was being spent on the wrong things, or at least on things that were not worth the money being spent, but those of us at the user level were like wrinkled old carpenters who knew the futility of arguing with whiz kid architects. "I have a degree," the architect would say. "I've studied these matters for 5 years. Just keep your mouth shut and drive in the nails." "Yes, sir," we'd think, and 5